UK MPs and peers of making biased and fabricated criticisms of Bahrain. The kingdom's rulers are squirming in the wake of more and more criticism coming from Britain.
My lords, earlier this year I raised with the noble Lord Lord Ahmed the detention of children in Bahrain following reports of their physical abuse and forced confessions.
My lords, a year ago this week, the Bahrain's courts upheld the death penalty for Mohammed Ramadan and Hussein Musa. Following commitments made to do so in the other place by the Minister for the Middle East and North Africa, what representations has Her Majesty's government made to the government of Bahrain on the death penalty?
The GCSS says Bahrain's interventions show, quote, ignorance and disregard for the many achievements Bahrain has made and is proud of in terms of human rights. But the UK seems unfazed by this. The GCSS is notorious for defending Bahrain's human rights record, and its chairman, Omar Al-Hassan, stands accused of being in the pocket of the Bahraini embassy in the UK. According to Liberal Democrat Pierre Lord Scriven, the GCSS's claims are nothing more than a continuation of the amateurish and slapdash approach by the Bahraini authorities to try and deny their appalling human rights record and undermine or try to silence those of us who speak up. Nonetheless, the UK and Bahrain are strategic allies, and the UK is reluctant to turn words into actions when it comes to defending Bahrain's prisoners of conscience. This is just another example of the hypocrisy and double standards exercised by Western governments that benefit from maintaining the status quo. Bianca Rahimi, London.
The right to assemble, to demonstrate, to be heard, a cornerstone of democracy, potentially under threat in proposed UK government legislation that gives the police sweeping new powers.
It does actually, in their opinion, violate civil liberties, existing civil liberties of society. And of course, with the backdrop of COVID and the draconian measures, and on the back of 20 years of increased police powers after the anti-terrorism laws, etc., that have come in to counter terrorism, there's a sort of nervousness.
And here is why it matters. Women being manhandled and handcuffed by police for attending a peaceful vigil held last year in the wake of 33-year-old Sarah Everard's murder at the hands of a police officer.
While the Conservative government claims the bill is aimed at proactively preventing chaos and disruption caused, for example, by people who glue their faces to motorways, its critics say the bill is not about law and order, but about taking away their right to protest.
The proposed legislation was quickly pushed through the House of Commons last year. This week it was put up for debate at the upper chamber of the UK Parliament amid cries of kill the bill from drum-beating protesters, forming an emotive backdrop to it outside the legislative body. What ensued was several amendments made to the proposed legislation to the chagrin of the government.
There is a general trend for government to grab more and more power and to reduce civil liberties. This is what's worrying. I think that the Lords ultimately, as you say, won't be able to stop it entirely. They can slow the process down, water it down slightly, but if governments are inexorably marching towards a greater totalitarian orientated set of legislature, then I'm afraid that at the moment, with the climate the way it is, politically, economically, etc., I don't think it'll be terribly difficult for them to push it through.
Campaigners say the parliamentary defeat came because people took to the streets and raised the alarm about the government's growing authoritarianism. They say it is now time to build the movement and kill the contentious bill once and for all. Saeed Purizza, London.
Islamic and national forces in the Gaza Strip held a demonstration in front of the Red Cross headquarters in solidarity with Palestinian prisoners held under administrative detention in Israeli jails. The protest comes as hundreds of inmates have already boycotted Israel's military court, demanding an end to its illegal administrative detention. About 500 administrative detainees began the new year by refusing to show up for their court sessions.
Israeli regime has renewed administrative detention against hundreds of Palestinian inmates.
Palestinians and human rights groups should do their best to put an end to the cruel policy. We stand by our brothers in Israeli jails who have boycotted Israel's military court. We also call on international human rights organizations to take a serious action.
The boycott of Israel's military court by Palestinian inmates comes as the health of the Palestinian hunger striker Nasser Abu Hamed is deteriorating. He has been in a coma for 11 days while in custody. Palestinian factions say the intentional medical negligence practiced by Israeli regime aims at killing the Palestinian prisoners.
Our message is clear. We will always support our detainees who stand against the brutal policies of the Israeli regime. Our brother Nasser Abu Hamed is in coma for 11 days due to medical negligence as Israel refuses to release him to provide him with proper medication. This amounts to a criminal act against our prisoners.
Public protests are mounting day by day against Israel's decision not to release Nasser Abu Hamed. Palestinians say they will hold Israel accountable if the inmate dies.
About 500 Palestinian detainees are refusing to show up for their court sessions, saying that this move is aimed at putting an end to the illegal Israeli administrative detention policy. They are also demanding the release of the hunger-striking prisoner Nasser Abu Hamed, who's on the verge of death. Ruba Shabet, Gaza.
Strikes, protests, and parliamentary disunity have shown that opposition to President Emmanuel Macron's pandemic policies have reached unprecedented levels. Macron dominates his party, and his party dominates Parliament. But France's controversial new vaccine smart pass was only just approved after more than 2 weeks of parliamentary chaos. It's one of the strictest vaccine passes in the world because it requires full vaccination. The vaccine hesitant can no longer provide proof of a negative COVID test to avoid almost total public isolation. There have been weeks of protests in favor of the rights of the non-vaccinated, and unions are planning enormous walkouts against a pandemic response which is accused of being imposed from above and without enough grassroots input.
In the end, it was Macron who decided alone, and that's why it's a big confuse for everyone. So, and that's why it makes a lot of confusion in the population, because just one guy who decides everything and a scientific committee who is more a justification for the decision that has been taken.
Vaccines in France are popular. 80% of the formerly vaccine-skeptical nation is now fully vaccinated. That has many saying that seemingly scapegoating the unvaccinated is a way for Macron to solidify a precarious re-election bid.
Despite his immensely controversial tenure, Macron retains a hardcore base of support of around 20%. It's been long assumed that it will be enough to get him into the second round, where he will defeat a challenger from the far right, like in 2017.
The decision is are very influenced by the fact that the election are coming in April. So it's really difficult to go to the mandatory vaccination for Emmanuel Macron. Maybe he want to wait for his probably re-election to go from the vaccinal pass to the mandatory vaccination.
The vaccine pass will likely be contested in France's top court, but it is expected to go into effect this week. The Omicron variant is far less deadly than previous versions, giving hope that the pandemic is ending. But it appears that the nation's pandemic policies will be a major part of the presidential election this April. Rami Mazahiri, Paris.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
Thank you.
log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Birthday of the Most Blessed Mother. In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. Heartiest felicitations to you on a very special day. Today, Mother's Day is being celebrated in the Islamic Republic of Iran, as well in countries and societies where women and motherhood are viewed from the standpoint of virtue, with respect, attached to them as the basic builders of sound and healthy societies. In sharp contrast to the decadent Western culture, where women are considered carnal and commercial commodities, Islam has designated a lofty position for the daughters of Eve in view of its emphasis on morally upright ladies from the beginning of creation, such as Sarah, the wife of Prophet Abraham, Mary, the mother of Prophet Jesus, and Khadija, the wife of the Prophet of Islam, with the noblest of them all being Hazrat Fatima Zahra, peace upon her, whose birthday we are celebrating today on the 20th of Jamadil Thani. Stay with us for a special feature on this most exemplary lady, the Immaculate Daughter of the Almighty's last and greatest messenger to all mankind, Prophet Muhammad. Blessings of God upon him and his progeny. In ayahs 58 and 59 of Surah Nahl of the Noble Quran, God Almighty relates to us part of the sorry state of affairs of the pre-Islamic society of Arabia that had degraded females to the worst ever position. When one of them is brought the news of a female newborn, his face becomes darkened and he chokes with suppressed agony. He hides from the people out of distress at the news he has been brought. Shall he retain it in humiliation or bury it in the ground? Look, evil is the judgment that they make. The ayahs that we recited to you depict the state of anguish and horror of a non-Muslim society at the birth of a daughter. The father is shocked at what he views as ignominy to him and his family. He is perplexed. He doesn't know what to do or what evil to commit against the newborn girl. The questions are, why should the father be shocked? Isn't the daughter a human being? Of course she is, but for a variety of reasons, he shudders at what awaits her when she grows up. Irrespective of the burden of dowry he may have to procure for at the time of her marriage, he's more worried about the dishonor she may bring for him and his tribe by being exploited by men of other clans whether or not he had treated the daughters of other people with respect. This disrespect for women was not restricted to the Arabs of the days of ignorance. It was, in fact, widespread in the supposedly civilized nations of the past and continues till this day in the modern world, despite the loud claims of women's rights, which are mostly ill-defined and are, in fact, in distortion of feminine virtues. In other words, because of the un-Islamic nature of the society, where often the rights of the females are denied, the prime cause of anguish is commercialization of women and their treatment as mere objects of carnal desires, and all these in the name of freedom and liberties. The other reasons of distress of fathers and parents whose hearts are devoid of true Islamic belief, even if they pay lip service to Islam, is the prospect of parting with family wealth as inheritance to her that would reduce the share of the sons. Still, in the case of those who have no proper cognizance of the infinite wisdom of God, the Almighty Creator, let alone acquaintance with the letter and spirit of the dynamism of Islam, the main reason of sadness at the birth of a daughter, especially when there is no son, is the horrifying thought of the end of lineage, for it is males who are considered the means of continuation of progeny. Thanks to Islam, all such notions regarding daughters were changed for good. For the first time in history, women found themselves placed on the pedestal of dignity and honor. Since the laws of God neither allow the abuse and commercialization of women as objects of carnal desire, nor do they impose excessive burden on the parents regarding dowry. All the same time, women have the right to education, the right to own property, the right to choose the spouse, the right to be active in social spheres, and the right to inherit and in turn pass an inheritance to children. They possess all these and several other rights, including the freedom of wearing the hijab and the liberty of being attired in modest clothing while in public, in order not to attract unnecessary and unwarranted attention from strangers. The hijab or the modest attire with head covering grants women freedom and liberty in the real sense of these terms, and with it dignity and respect in society that gives meaning to life. As the other half of mankind, it is the woman who, in addition to providing peace and solace to the husband, plays the fundamental role in building a sound and healthy society by bringing up children in the proper manner on the basis of faith and moral values, factors that rule out immorality and with it any agonizing thoughts for parents. That was the reason Prophet of Islam told one of the new Muslim Arabs who frowned on receiving news of the birth of a daughter to him, "The earth bears her, the heavens shade her, and the Almighty gives her food. For you, she is like a flower. Smell her fragrance." On another occasion, in order to remove misconceptions from the society, the Prophet marked 12 graces descend over the person's house where there are daughters. Heavenly blessings are showered on that house, and angels visit that house for a glimpse. The Almighty's greatest messenger was not a mere preacher, but a practical demonstrator of whatever the all-wise Creator revealed to him for the good of mankind. He set the personal example, and it is for this reason the Noble Quran calls him the excellent exemplar. Thus, on the 20th of Jamadi Thani, Divine Providence decided to reward Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, with the greatest of perpetual gifts. After he and his beloved wife, Hazrat Khadija, the Ummul Mu'mineen, or mother of all true believers, peace upon her, lost their two sons, Qasim and Tahir, in infancy. The pagan Arabs, such as Aus ibn Wail, tried to mock the Prophet as Abtar, which literally means tailless and refers to the one without progeny. They thought the name of the person whose mission they had no belief would soon disappear and die out, while their ill-begotten brats would guarantee the continuation of their lineage. Day. To the bewilderment of these retarded minds, God not only granted the Prophet a radiant daughter, conceived of the fruit of paradise he ate during his mi'raj, or physical ascension to the heavens and back to planet Earth in a fraction of a night, but as the following surah bears testimony, the perpetuity of his blessed offspring, similar to the perennially inexhaustible fountain of Kothar. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate, indeed, we have granted you Kothar. So pray to your Lord and offer sacrifice. Indeed, it is your enemy who is without posterity. The hypocrites amongst the Muslims might deny that Kothar refers to the Prophet's impeccable daughter, the noblest ever lady of all times, or Sayyidatun Nisa al-Alamin min al-Awwalin wal-Akhirin. But, as is obvious by the last part of this surah, which says, indeed your enemy is without posterity, Kothar is undoubtedly a reference to Hazrat Fatima Zahra, peace upon her, whose progeny has multiplied and spread all over the world, while that of his enemies has long disappeared. Today, as we celebrate Mother's Day in the Islamic Republic of Iran and other Islamic societies abroad, in honor of the infallible mother who gave to the world such all-time perfect sons and daughters like Imam Hassan, Imam Hussein, Hazrat Zainab, and Hazrat Kulthum, peace upon them, let us refer to a hadith from the Prophet mentioned in the books of our Sunni brethren, such as Sahih Bukhari, Sahih Muslim, Musnad ibn Hanbal, etc., regarding Kothar and its connection to the person without whom the Prophet's only daughter would have remained an unmarried, like the Virgin Mary. Kothar is a stream of super excellence exclusively belonging to me. Only the righteous believers among my followers will be allowed to drink from it. Ali, peace upon him, will distribute water from it to them. On the day of judgment, I will see some of my companions driven like the cattle away from Kothar. It will be announced that they are those who, after my departure from the world, deviated from the true religion and introduced innovations to corrupt the faith. It is recorded that from that day onwards, one of the epithets of Imam Ali, peace upon him, became Saqiyul Kothar, meaning the one who quenches the thirst of believers at the heavenly stream of Kothar, and the one who is the husband of Kothar, that is, Hazrat Fatima Zahra, peace upon her, in whose honor God has revealed several ayahs of the Noble Quran. How can mortals pen the merits of the Immaculate Daughter of the Almighty's last and greatest messenger, the impeccable wife of the commander of all the true believers, the infallible mother of the leaders of the youth of paradise, and the exceptional teacher of all those girls and women eager to achieve feminine virtue as they strive towards the proximity of the loving creator of the universe? During childhood, Fatima, peace upon her, whose spiritual glories kept her above material matters, had so dedicatedly taken care of her widowed father that she earned the epithet of Umabiha, or mother of her father. This concept and this demonstration of fatherly and daughterly love was to revolutionize society. Thus, the virtues of Hazrat Fatima, peace upon her, are not solely related to paradise in afterlife or the day of judgment, on when she will intercede in the divine court for the forgiveness of multitudes of the faithful who had erred, but are ubiquitous in the transient world, since she is the pivotal figure of the blessed group whom God calls Ahlul Bayt in Ayah 33 of Surah Ahzab of the Noble Quran, and whose blessings cover all aspects of our life and faith. Indeed, Allah desires to keep away uncleanness from you, Ahlul Bayt, and preserve you thoroughly purified. Time does not permit us to go into details of this ayah or of ayah 61 of Surah Al Imran, on the revelation of which the Prophet took his daughter as the only female along with her husband and two sons and no one else besides, for the unique challenge of Mubahale with the Christians of Najran that marked the resounding triumph of Islam. No wonder the Redeemer of mankind, who will reappear in the end times as Imam Mahdi al-Qa'im, peace upon him, to establish the global government of peace, prosperity and justice, is the direct descendant of Hazrat Fatima Zahra, peace upon her.
Us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of information.
The Spotlight.
Thank you.
Welcome to Spotlight. Saudi Arabia has intensified its airstrikes on Yemen, killing dozens of civilians in its latest air attacks, that is, on two key cities. A frenzied bombing campaign comes amid the Yemeni army's successful retaliatory operations and major advances made against the Saudi and Emirati-backed militants. What are the consequences of the recent escalation for the region and beyond? And where is the deadly war heading for? These are some of the issues that we'll try to discuss in this edition of Spotlight.
There's no end in sight to the Saudi-led aggression against Yemen. Riyadh and its allies commit yet another inhumane crime amid the deafening silence of the United Nations and other international bodies and so-called advocates of human rights. Saudi warplanes bombarded the western city of Hodeidah and a detention center in the northern city of Saada within hours. Dozens of people, including children, were reportedly killed in Saada alone. The overnight strike on Hodeidah also left several casualties, most of them children. The strikes triggered a nationwide internet blackout in the country. The Norwegian ambassador to the United Nations, whose country holds the presidency of the UN Security Council for January, has reacted to the strikes.
New attack or series of attacks is at least 60 dead, maybe as many as 100. I mean, that can't be acceptable, can it?
No, I mean, it's not acceptable, and we absolutely call for restraints on all sides.
On Friday, thousands of Yemenis staged a rally in Sana'a to denounce the latest deadly airstrikes. The protesters condemned the United States for arming and backing Riyadh and its allies in the war on Yemen. The coalition has stepped up airstrikes against Yemen in recent weeks, killing dozens of civilians, including children.
Now we have become afraid day and night and in the morning. You don't know when the strikes will happen. The homes of citizens are now military targets, and this is what we fear. You fear that you will take children to school or to the hospitals or something like that, and you will get hit.
The spike in Saudi-led aggression follows Yemen's successful operation deep inside the UAE in retaliation for its role in the Saudi-led onslaught. During the operation, several sensitive locations in Dubai and Abu Dhabi, such as airports and oil refineries, were targeted with drones and ballistic missiles. Saudi Arabia and its allies, including the UAE, launched a devastating war on Yemen in 2015 in an attempt to reinstate a friendly regime there. The kingdom has also maintained a blockade on Yemen ever since it began the war, while the impoverished country is in dire need of basic supplies such as food and medicine. Years of bombing and blockade have left hundreds of thousands of Yemenis dead and displaced millions of them. The impoverished country is experiencing what the UN has described as the world's worst humanitarian crisis.
Well, joining us on this edition of The Spotlight, we have activist and political commentator Hossein Al-Buhayri, who's joining us from the Yemeni capital, Sana'a. And we also have Ken Stone from the Hamilton Coalition to Stop the War, who's with us from Hamilton, Ontario.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Let's start off with Mr. Al-Buhayri in Sana'a. Let's discuss the recent increased Saudi-led airstrikes on Yemen. Give us your assessment of the targets and the consequences of the recent escalation for the security of the region.
First of all, this is not the first time that the Saudi target a prison. The casualty of the latest attack on Saada prison has reached 223, including about 85 dead. And they have targeted before a prison in Hudaydah, killing and injuring hundreds, and as well in the Mar city. They have targeted a prison which was prisoners of war were held there, killing and injuring more than 300. So that's why this latest attack shows that the Saudi, and especially United Arab Emirates, because they have failed to target the Yemeni army forces in the battlefield, either in Shabwa or in Marib, they have trying to take revenge from the Yemeni civilians. There is no fuel. There are less cars on the street, maybe 80% less than normal. The fuel price has increased. It used to be 8,000 riyal for 20 liter. It costs now almost 30,000 riyal because Saudi and UAE, backed by the United States and UK, has blocked fuel ship from entering Hudaydah port. And those latest attacks show how weak is the United Arab Emirates. They couldn't actually protect their country. They should expect that Yemeni army will launch more attack against them, because as long as they target Yemen, as long as they keep targeting civilians, enforcing the blockade, supporting separatists and militia and terrorist group on the ground, Yemeni army has the full right to target United Arab Emirates. And I believe maybe in the coming hours there might be a huge attack on United Arab Emirates. And here in Sana'a they have advised foreign company and as well flight company who are working in Abu Dhabi and as well in Dubai, they should stop using those airports, because after the latest attack, and as Al-Amid Yahya Sari', the spokesperson of Yemeni army, has announced that United Arab Emirates is unsafe state. That's why I believe any civilian casualty, if it will happen in next attack on United Arab Emirates, that the United Arab Emirates bear the full responsibility, and as well the foreign company. Because if it was any other airport in Europe or in the US, if there was a small incident, the entire airport will be shut down. But I believe that United Arab Emirates will not do that, and they will not stop their war against Yemen unless Yemeni will launch a huge attack, because they have the means, they have the weapons to do that. And now Sana'a will bear some of the responsibility of those civilians that are killed today and during the seven years of the war and blockade in Yemen,
right,
because they have now the will and they have the equipment to target United Arab Emirates.
Let's bring in Mr. Ken Stone in the discussion. The Yemeni army launched retaliatory drone attacks deep inside the United Arab Emirates on Monday, as alluded to by our guest in Sana'a. The attack by the Yemeni army on the UAE sent a message to the aggressors that the attacks resulting in civilian deaths in Yemen will not go unanswered. How much, in your opinion, can these reprisal attacks change the dynamics of the war?
I think the reprisal attacks can very much change the dynamics of the war. When the war started, the Saudi coalition, which includes the U.S. and the U.K. and is backed up by arms sales from, unfortunately, my own country, Canada, thought that it would be a matter of months or weeks even, and the Yemeni people, who are from the poorest country in the Arab world, would cave in and give up. But instead, the Yemeni people have rallied to protect their national sovereignty and territorial integrity, and they have not only resisted the illegal war of aggression by the Saudi coalition, but they have managed, against all odds and with tremendous courage, to take the fight right back into Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates. They are taking the war back to where the aggressors live, and they are hitting important installations such as their oil facilities and airports and so on. Of course, it's always regrettable when civilians are killed in war, but the people who bear the responsibility, the ultimate responsibility for the deaths of civilians, are the people who start the war of aggression. This was established 70 years ago at the Nuremberg War Crimes Tribunal. The the party which starts a war of aggression bears the responsibility for all the evils of war, the deaths, the destruction, the rape, the murder, everything else. And so we must lay the blame on the aggressors here, the Saudi coalition.
Right. Hossein Al-Bukhaytia, the Yemeni army also released footage of operations against Saudi and UAE-led mercenaries and Daesh terrorists in Shabwa province. Another example of Yemeni victories on the ground. Do you think the Saudis have underestimated the defensive capabilities of the Yemeni forces?
Yes, they did, because we remember General Al-Asiri, the previous spokesperson of the Saudi-led coalition, has announced after 3 weeks of starting the war and blockade on Yemen that they have destroyed between 90 and 95 of Yemeni military equipment and ballistic missiles and others. And they used to conduct hundreds of airstrikes a day, about 200,000. Airstrike has been conducted against Yemen since the beginning of the war, and you can imagine all those airstrikes, they have not stopped the capability of Yemeni army and armed force to attack and target Saudi Arabia. And this shows exactly that the Saudi Arabia and UAE coalition strike on Yemen, they mainly target civilians as the latest attack. Just in the last 2 or 3 days, they have targeted Sana'a, killing about 20 civilians, 12 of them from one family. They have targeted Al Ain Hospital 2 days ago in Shabwa, killing and injuring several patients and doctors in there. And I mean, I don't know why they have actually waste that amount of fighter jets and as well of rocket and missiles that might cost hundreds of thousands of dollars. They have to target civilians. I mean, they could actually focus on the battlefield. They could focus on Marib and on other area. But they think that those type of attack will have pressure on Yemeni civilians. They want to bring Yemenis to submit to this Saudi coalition war on Yemen. But I believe that more attack like that on civilians, it will result in more people joining the Yemeni army to try to fight face-to-face with the Saudi-backed forces in many areas in Yemen. And I believe if Yemeni army will continue its attack, especially against United Arab Emirates, that United Arab Emirates, because of its reputation, and many companies work there, most of their income is coming from tourists and from foreign company and importing and exporting and oil. So if they focus the attack, if they continue the attack, I don't think that this war will continue. And just last thing, what add insult to injury is that UN Security Council and the United Nations, they have condemned the attack on United Arab Emirates. They have condemned that Yemeni army has seized that United Arab Emirates flagship, which was carrying weapons. But on the other hand, they have not condemned any attack or strike that kills civilians.
Ken Stone, if none of Riyadh's objectives have been met, does this mean, is it safe to deduce that the Saudis are worse off now more than ever over the course of the 7 years of the war?
Absolutely. They are losing the war in Yemen, and they have lost the war against Syria. So the Saudi royal family has waged two wars, which they are losing badly. And I think this will come back to haunt them. I think this will also come back to haunt the monarchy in the United Arab Emirates. And I do want to take up the point of your other guest as well. It is shameful that the United Nations, which mourned the loss of civilian life in the recent attack on UAE, has not come out and done the right thing, for which it was set up in 1945 to end the scourge of war. It should have labeled the Saudi coalition as the aggressor and taken action, collective action, against the coalition itself. But that does not mean that the people who are your listeners around the world can't do anything because the UN has failed to act appropriately. They need to put pressure on their governments to cease any arms sales to any part of the Saudi coalition. In Canada, we have had a number of demonstrations at plants and in front of members of parliament's offices demanding an end to arms sales to Saudi Arabia. And many, apparently, our colleagues in other countries have done the same, because many countries in Europe have said that they will not anymore sell arms to the Saudi coalition. And I applaud those people and those countries in Europe that have taken that position. But more needs to be done in this regard. And I wish also to mention our own foreign minister, Madame Joly, who just the other day in two tweets said that Canada strongly condemns the civilian deaths in the UAE, and her thoughts are with the victims, and she called on the Houthis to stop their attacks. Well, you know, I have been following this war for 7 long years now, and I cannot remember one occasion when the Canadian foreign minister has ever said that their thoughts went with the victims of the Saudi coalition attacks in Yemen. And there weren't just 3 victims in Yemen. There are now 377,000 victims of the Saudi coalition attacks in Yemen. And where is our foreign minister when this happens?
Mr. Abu Haiti, there were massive demonstrations in Yemen. Thousands of Yemenis rallied in Sana'a to denounce the recent deadly airstrikes by the Saudi-led coalition. Are we seeing the resistance front gaining more and more support as each day goes by and as each attack takes place?
Yes, of course, because each attack conducted and strike conducted by the Saudi-led coalition, especially when it kills Yemeni civilians, many people will join the battlefield because they have this clearly now that what the Saudi want in Yemen is not that as they call to bring security to Yemen or to bring Hadi legitimacy. We've seen what's happening in the south with the United Arab Emirates creating separatists, using terrorist group to fight Sana'a forces. And this is a clear, the protest today is a clear message that the United States is behind this. I mean, even though that the Biden administration has said that they will stop the sales of weapons to Saudi Arabia, but they haven't done any of that. And the latest attack and strikes on Yemen shows that it is with the help of the United States. And many countries, of course, they have condemned the attack against United Arab Emirates, especially countries from Arab nations who are involved in this war in the Saudi coalition. United Kingdom, France, and U.S. and Canada, they are making billions of dollars, tens of billions of dollars in profit from this war. And it's really, really shameful for United Nations and UN Security Council and as well other countries that they are worried about what they say, the security of the region, the security of Saudi Arabia. I mean, what about the security of Yemen? What about hundreds of thousands of Yemeni civilians, most of them are children that have been killed by this war, either by direct airstrike or blockade? I mean, Yemen is in Yemen, it's not on the moon, it just have border with Saudi Arabia and it's close to United Arab Emirates. So the security, what Sana'a now want to send a clear message that the security of Yemen is a part of the security of United Arab Emirates and Saudi Arabia and the region. And if those countries will not stop what they have created in Yemen, the fire that they have created and the fight that they have created, it will be brought to those two countries. And I believe that this is the only action that can stop this war, because we should not anymore believe in the United Nations, because they have been exposed from the beginning of the war in Yemen and as well in Syria and in other countries.
Mr. Kenstone, there's another alarming angle to all of this, as there may be another entity that's willing to participate in the bombing of Yemen, and that's the Israeli regime. Israel has announced that it will come to the aid of the UAE and support any military action against Yemen. Do you believe Israel's intentions are for the safety of the UAE, or is the regime pursuing its own ulterior motives?
Well, let's remember that the UAE and several other Arab governments recently opened up formal relations with the apartheid state of Israel. And this didn't really change anything. It just brought into the open what they've been doing in secret all along, and that is collaborating with the state of Israel to maintain U.S. hegemony over the entire region. The state of Israel, along with the UAE and the Saudi monarchy, are the main bases of the main pillars of U.S. domination over the region. And so it's no surprise to me that Israel says that they're planning to get involved. I believe they are already involved. I can't believe that they wouldn't be. because they have their dirty hands in every war of the U.S. empire, whether it's in Syria or Iraq or Afghanistan. It doesn't matter. They're in there like a dirty shirt. The purpose of this war was from the very start to maintain U.S. hegemony over the strategic and oil-rich Middle East. And despite what Biden said 1 year ago in February that the U.S. would not support, they wanted to see an end to the war in Yemen, and they would not support offensive military operations. They would cut their trade deal, their arms deals with the Saudis if the war continued. Still, the war is going ahead because the strategic aim remains the same, which is to say, to keep U.S. hegemony. And I don't think that the people of Yemen have any other alternative but to resist this illegal war and take the war back into the capitals of those Arab countries that are waging the war in order to put a price for the war on those aggressor countries such that they drop out of this war. And
okay.
I believe that they need to do so.
Okay, we're short of time. Let's get a final thought in from Mr. Al-Bukhaiti. It's been reported that the UAE is setting up an espionage center for the Israeli regime at Socotra Airport in southern Yemen. Will Israeli cooperation, in your opinion, lead to the regime's wider military participation in the conflict?
I don't think any involvement from the Zionist state will make any difference, because United Arab Emirates had a great relation with the Zionist state of Israel from the beginning of the war. Of course, it was secret relation. From the beginning of the war, I believe that the Zionist state was helping United Arab Emirates and Saudi, and some of the airstrike at the beginning of the war that was conducted with those huge bombs that targeted Sana'a, killing and injuring hundreds of Yemeni civilians. I believe that those could be a fighter jet from Israel or as well from the United States. And I think the latest relation or open relation between United Arab Emirates and Israel is because United Arab Emirates want to get the Zionist state of Israel more involved in this war. But I'm sure the attack against United Arab Emirates and Saudi and direct attack against older infrastructure like airport and port, I think this is the only way to stop the war against Yemen.
All right. Thanks a lot, gentlemen, activists and political commentator Hossein Al-Bukhaiti joining us from the Yemeni capital, Sana'a. And thanks to Ken Stone from the Hamilton Coalition to Stop the War, joining us from Hamilton, Ontario. And a special thanks to you for staying with us on tonight's edition of The Spotlight.